Well, if it isn't another episode of I'll Grieve You With This. Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for clicking on the thing. It's the host, Micah Walsh. That's me. The podcast is called I'll Grieve You With This. Surely you know this by now. And I appreciate you coming back. This episode, I had a great conversation with comedian Annie Russell. And I hope you folks at home enjoy listening to it. Without further ado, this is episode 26 with Annie Russell. All right, welcome to the podcast, Annie Russell. I appreciate you coming over here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, not only do I appreciate in advance all the personal stuff you're going to share, but thank you for walking me through how to use my own audio program. This is a very good booking for me.
You heard it here first. Book me on your podcast. I will help you troubleshoot.
Yeah, yeah. You're gonna help me edit this too, right?
Yeah,
and
no,
just walk me through this.
Just send me the file. Yeah, I'll turn it around for you in like 24.
I appreciate that. So yeah, welcome to the podcast. This is interview 26, if you can believe it or not. And like probably my past five or six guests, you and I sort of know each other just through the scene. I enjoy your comedy, but it would be a stretch to say that we have like a, this is our first conversation in depth. So, but obviously I need to know a little bit about people's background to book this. I know that we're both members of the Dead Parent Club. You are
correct.
Two times over. Mm-hmm. My condolences. And I'd like to explore all that, but before we dive into that, for a little context and for my listeners, can you tell me, you know, where you're from and when you started doing comedy and sort of where you're at now? And then, you know, then we'll dip our toes into the shallow end and then maybe go into the deep end.
So I grew up in New York, actually, and I moved back home, not home, like to my childhood home, but back to New York about 2 years ago. I've been doing stand-up for about 11 years, and I consider my home scene to be Burlington, Vermont. That's where I like mostly started. Vermont Comedy Club was kind of my home club for a long time, and that's where I was living to work a job in public radio. When I really started stand-up, like for real, I had done a little bit of stand-up in New York, but I'm sort of glad that I left New York to do stand up for many years and then came back because I just got the opportunity for way more stage time. But I also lived in Chicago for like 3 years. So I claim Chicago as not like a home scene, but as like kind of like an adopted little second scene that I also was part of for a little bit.
Yeah, cool. That gets us up to speed. I actually knew you primarily as a Chicago comic. Well, clearly I didn't know you. But that's cool. So Vermont is where you started, and you're an audio engineer.
Yeah. I'm an editor for an NPR segment called StoryCorps. And it's kind of nice. Apt to talk about it on this podcast because like our whole thing is like our stories make people cry. We cover a lot of like death, illness, grief. We have a lot of upbeat and joyful stories as well, but like a lot of our bread and butter is those like kind of really tough conversations between people. So what I like to tell people is I make people cry for my day job and then laugh at night. And so it's all just about like manipulating people's emotions.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's nice to have a little bit of levity. It's nice that you provide a space for people to talk about what is not usually, you know, a water cooler conversation. I found out about your grief because you were cracking jokes about it the other night.
And, yeah. It's funny because I think I like threw in an orphan joke as in an open mic set as kind of a transition. And it's from like a way longer chunk that I used to do. Like I used to have a lot of orphan material and like I talked about it a lot more. In the past couple of years, I've actually like challenged myself to not rely on that so much as like a bit of a crutch because it is like something that I kind of had it really was my comedic identity for a long time. It's how people knew me. There were like articles where people would call me up and ask me about processing, you know, grief through humor. And so I felt like it was a little bit of like a box I was putting myself in. And so I've kind of challenged myself to get away from it. But recently I've been kind of like sprinkling it back in.
What do you think you got out of the period of when you were writing all those jokes? Because similarly, as soon as my dad died, I went to an open mic, you know, 5 days later. And then I was dragging around these terrible jokes that were just like, but I needed to get it out of my system. And then for a couple of years, I didn't think about it. And then I did also revisit it and wrote some more in-depth stuff. But I could definitely understand not wanting to be pigeonholed as the girl with the dead parents or the sad guy, or it's like, hey man,
right,
we heard this stuff last year, you're still on about that. But what I've learned is I'm gonna be on about the grief that I have forever. You know, it doesn't really lessen, it just sort of changes. But so what did you turn it into, a show, or is it was just such primarily what your material was that...
So there was a period of time where it was a lot of my material. So for a little bit of background, like my dad died in 2008 and my mom died in 2016. So when my dad died, I was like just out of college and was not doing stand up yet. So that didn't even come into play. Whereas when my mom died, I think I went to an open mic the next day and told like the worst, like exactly what you're describing. Just
sure.
Like the saddest, worst, like darkest, like I think I made a joke about her being in hell, and it was just like,
sure,
okay, like this, she's going through some stuff, must have been what people felt at that time. But like I needed to go through that like kind of cringy public grief phase to kind of just even begin to make sense of what happened.
Oh yeah, it's like emotional vomit when you're up there and you're just like, this isn't what I wanted to write jokes about, but it's the only thing
coming out of my mouth.
It's the only thing that I can think about in this moment, and I need you guys to know that I'm making jokes because I'm so broken right now.
Exactly. So that was also my experience. And you know, I think what I have learned, and what like I knew intellectually but I had to like learn in a really emotional way, is like the audience can tell if you're not okay, and you have to be okay before you can tell a joke about something. Like if you want the audience to laugh, they have to know ahead of time that you're all right and it's all going to be okay, and they're not witnessing some kind of like public meltdown. So I think like for me, I learned a little bit more about how to joke about it. Like at first, I was opening sets with it, right? I was just like going straight into
it. It's a good way to start, to break the ice.
Yeah. And so, and then I kind of learned, it's like, no, they need some like light upbeat. They need to know you're just kind of a nice girl. And then, you know, you can hit them with some jokes about, you know, just being an orphan named Annie, which is objectively funny.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, it's just like,
I didn't even put that together.
Yeah. So like that's...
these jokes write themselves.
Right. So it's like I kind of let myself write those jokes for a long time. I would say probably for like a good, you know, 5 years. That was like a big part of, you know, what I considered to be like my, you know, in my tight 15, you know, it like kind of my best jokes. But like I said, like I've been challenging myself to write about things that are not that, just like, you know, I go through the phase that a lot of people do when they first start comedy, where a lot of jokes are about like sex, dating, and relationships. And, you know, same way I did the exercise of like challenging myself to write about other topics, like I kind of feel the same way about the grief stuff. So, you know, if a great joke comes, great. But one thing that has been happening recently, for the first time in the past year, I've been able to write jokes about my mom's life. You know, like not the death, not the mourning process or like all the aftermath of my family, but like how she was just kind of a weird lady, and there's like funny stuff in there, but I couldn't even touch that for like a long time. And now I'm like, you know, finally at the place where I've done like enough work that I can just kind of write jokes about like just who my parents were as people.
That's cool. Yeah. Do you mind telling me about what your parents' sense of humor was like?
Yeah, that's such a good question. Like, my dad had a pretty sarcastic and dry sense of humor. If you've ever seen my comedy, you can probably kind of see where I'm going with this. But my dad was very funny, just like very quick. You know, not necessarily like a big punchline silly guy, but just like super sharp and super quick with an observation about anything that was going on. And I definitely like picked that up from him, I think. But I would say like in general was kind of like a serious dude. Like, my dad was the guy who like wore a suit to work every day and like commuted an hour back and forth to work. And like, we didn't see him at all until 7:30, 8 o'clock at night. And it was very like, my parents were very strict. Rules were very important. Like, structure was really important. So like the rare moments when my dad would kind of like let the humor come through, it was like noticeable, you know, because he was a pretty serious guy. And my mom, I don't even know where to start. My mom was like a total wild card of a human being, like very quirky to say the least. Always had like a half finished art project going, always was kind of like just very, very unintentionally funny with how eccentric she was. And so that's that was kind of her personality.
So you mostly got your comedic stuff from your dad?
I think so. I think my mom really liked to laugh, but I don't remember my mom ever like making a joke or saying something funny that she meant as funny, you know?
Okay, yeah, sure. Unintentionally hilarious.
Right, right. Like, I'm thinking about a time that she wanted to write a cookbook about authentic Native American cuisine, which is not something she is an authority on in any way, and is certainly not something that, like, my family should be an authority on.
Sure.
In terms of like, we do not have that in our family heritage or background. Sure. So she got really interested in that.
Were both your parents from New York?
No, actually, my dad was a lifelong New Yorker.
And you grew up in Manhattan, or
I grew up in the North Bronx in Riverdale.
Okay.
But my dad was born and raised in Washington Heights. His parents were from Ireland, and my mom actually grew up in L.A.
Okay.
So she had a very different just sensibility than my dad. They were very like kind of opposite in terms of just, my dad was like the very stereotypical fast talking New Yorker, down to business type person, everything like, you know, early was on time kind of person. And my mom had the most, unfortunately, stereotypical California outlook on things, like, we're not in a rush to do anything. Like, her speech pattern was slower. Like, it was definitely like a little bit of an opposites attract situation. But yeah, they met at work, actually.
Okay. And you have siblings?
I do. I have three brothers and a sister.
Oh, wow.
So big
family. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Do you mind telling me about what it was like when your father passed away? Was there any moments? Well, actually, just tell me what that was like.
Yeah. So with my dad, you know, his actual death happened right after I graduated from college. And that's obviously like a really transitional time for anybody. So thinking about me being 22 and really not having myself together in terms of what I wanted to do, what I wanted, like, I was technically working, but like, I was not at a job that was going to be a job that I kept. Definitely felt like a kid in many ways still. And I think what's important to remember is that's also how my parents treated me. They were definitely... the one thing that really sticks out to me about my dad's death is my parents and my entire family like did not trust me with a lot of information. So what happened was that my dad got diagnosed with pancreatic cancer 2 years before he died. And it was actually kind of amazing that he made it 2 years. They gave him 6 months to live. And yeah,
that is impressive.
At that time, you know, my parents did not tell me that. Like, I did not know about that 6 month prognosis until years after he died. My older brother actually told me like years later. He was like, "Oh yeah, do you remember that Christmas? You know, that first Christmas after dad got cancer?" And I was like, "Yeah, I remember. Like, you came home." And he was like, "Yeah, like, why do you think we all were there when, you know, typically with like a big family, there's usually at least some of us who are like with in-laws or with girlfriend, boyfriends, families. And it just kind of like, we weren't necessarily the family that always got together everybody on Christmas. But that first Christmas after he got diagnosed, my sister flew in from LA. Like, everybody was there. We took like a million pictures. And now that I look back on that, I was like, oh, they all knew.
You're saying that all of your siblings were informed except for you?
My older siblings knew, like, how, like, the prognosis.
Where do you fall in the chronology?
So I'm number four.
Okay.
So
and you have a younger?
I have a younger brother.
Okay. Did he know?
No. So
it's really weird.
So
and 21 is when, how old you would have been? 20, 21?
So I was like 20, and
it's
he
not
was
too young to find out about reality.
He was 18. So they told us about the cancer. We knew about the cancer, but we did not know about like the severity of it or the fact that they were giving him 6 months. That was not information that they shared with us. And so I knew it. And looking back on that, I'm like, I really wish that was information that I would have had. You know, I definitely
would have spent your time differently.
I totally would have spent my time differently. I would have made so much more of an effort to be home more. But as it was, like, keep in mind, I'm a college student and then a recent college graduate. So like the last thing I wanted to do was like hang out with my parents all the time.
Yeah, of course.
You know,
and you didn't realize the depth of the situation.
Exactly.
Can you tell me, did your dad, did he continue to work? And I know a lot of people when they get, well, I understand wanting to keep the timeline or prognosis to yourself. A lot of people are suffering in silence.
Mm-hmm.
Did he continue to work, or what was his reaction to this?
So my dad is part of a group that I think people will recognize this. So when my dad got sick, he was recently retired. And so like, this is something that like I've learned happens a lot, where some people stop working and then they immediately like get sick.
Interesting.
It's almost like he didn't know what to do with himself. So yeah, he was retired by the time this happened. And so, yeah, it was all about like doctor's appointments and all of that stuff. But again, I wasn't living at home, so I didn't really have like a day to day knowledge of what was happening.
Pancreatic cancer is no joke.
Yeah. And now I kind of like, know a little bit more about it because, you know, not only were my older siblings like told more information as it was happening, but my younger brother was still living at home. So he was the one who was like taking my dad to doctor's appointments. And like, he eventually was well aware of like how bad it was. And he could see how sick my dad was getting, you know, in real time.
What was your dad's, how was his approach to death? Did he talk about it at all, or was he in complete denial, or was there somewhere in between?
It's so funny we're talking about this because this is like something I haven't thought about in a long time. I literally don't know, because if he talked about it, it wasn't with me. Like, I remember it not being something that was discussed. And like, keep in mind, like when someone's like dying from like an aggressive cancer, like it becomes pretty clear at a certain point, like what's going on. And so he got, he went into hospice. Like he had a home hospice worker come. And even then, like my mom told me about it in such a dismissive kind of way. It's like, oh yeah, there's going to be somebody like coming to the house, whatever. And I wasn't living home, so I didn't see it. And the last Thanksgiving that we had together, we had to have Thanksgiving like next to his bed, in my parents' room. And like, that was the first time that I really knew like, oh, he's like going to die relatively soon. And even in that moment, all he said to me was like, everything's going to be okay.
How long was he in hospice for?
A few months. So it was, yeah.
And it was at home?
It was at home. Yeah. Yeah, he didn't go to the hospital until like the last 2 days.
Yeah, that's tough. But what did you say? He said everything's going to be okay.
That's all he said to me. There was like a really like a brief moment where we were alone where I was like asking him. He had like asked me to make him some food. And so I like went and made him like this, like there had been like meatloaf for dinner the night before. So I made him like this little meatloaf sandwich. And it was something that I always like kind of did for my dad. I'd like make him like a little snack. And he was just like, everything's gonna be okay. And like wouldn't acknowledge it to me at all, like what was happening. And then, you know, that was Thanksgiving. So that's late November. And he was, you know, in that final stretch of those final couple of days in the hospital by like the first week of December.
Were you staying at home at this point?
No, I didn't. And I don't, like, looking back, I regret that. But at the time, I was really like scared of what was happening.
Yeah, of course.
And I didn't want to like be there. And so, of course, like looking back, I would have spent my time differently. Like I would have gone home more. I would have like stayed, you know, in that period in between Thanksgiving and when he died. But I didn't really have like a framework to process it. And no one was talking about it.
Yeah. And hospice can be such a fluid or timeline. Your father was in hospice for a couple months. My dad, he was hospitalized on Tuesday and he came home for hospice and he died within like 4 days.
Wow.
Which in retrospect I see as more of a blessing than if it had gone for a couple months and him just losing lucidity and we would have all had to go home. Thankfully, so I have 3 siblings as well, and we were all on the East Coast. My dad was in Minnesota, and we all got the call like, hey, it's kind of going to be like, you got to get here. My brother was in Europe at the time. And yeah, and my dad, he didn't really, you know, as close as he got to verbally accepting it out loud to me was like, this is it. I guess this is it. And I've said it before, but this healthcare worker was like, good news, Mr. Walsh, your hospice is totally covered by Medicare. And he said, well, you know, I can't resist a good deal, which is the most dry gallows humor. Yeah. But he was very much, he'd been hospitalized 5 times in the last year or so. And he was ready to not be in a hospital. He certainly, I don't think, was ready to die. But up until that last week, he didn't really vocalize. And that's interesting, the thing you say about if he did say it, it wasn't to you. I hear stories of him saying things to like his buddies, but I don't really when I hear, I'm like, I don't know, that doesn't sound like something he would have said out loud, but who knows.
Yeah, that's and I think like that's part of the process too, is like realizing like we only know our parents through the lens that we know them, you know?
Yes.
And like, you don't even have the same parent as your sibling does, you know, in many ways. Like everybody has their different relationship based on birth order and gender, and it's all like realizing the complexity of like the human being that you don't have any control over, and you don't have you just don't have a full knowledge of. Like I remember when I first found out that my dad had cancer, it was because my uncle called and left a message on the answering machine.
Wow.
And it said, "Hey, Rich, like, I heard you had cancer. Just wanted to call and check in." And that's how I found out.
Holy shit. Well, that's a tough way to learn the news.
Yeah.
But also, who leaves a voicemail like that? "Hey, I heard it's stage four. Just checking in. Hit me back and get some beers."
I mean, we're talking about, like, you know, people like boomers who, you know, have limited grasp on technology. But it's funny because, like, then I remember asking my dad about it and him just be like, "Oh, that's an exaggerated
inside
rumor."
Joke.
And I was just like, "Oh my God, like this." So that's like the level of how little, like how much they tried to like shelter me from this.
Yeah. That's why do you think that was? Why do you think there was a distinction between you and your other siblings? Were you the cutoff?
I don't know
The three older ones knew.
Yeah, so the three older ones knew, and you know, there's a gap between me and my sister. So my older siblings are like a good, you know, like, you know, years older than us. And so me and my younger brother, I think it became clear really quickly that like my younger brother was living at home. He knew. You know, he knew everything that was going on. He saw the prescriptions and the doctor's appointments. Like, everything was out in the open for him. But for me, like, I was in college. And then when I graduated, I think I graduated on a Saturday. And I had a job that started on Monday. And I, like, never lived home after I graduated because I, like, didn't really want to. I, like, moved straight to Brooklyn. And I just, like, wasn't there. And also, like, I'm a really sensitive person. I've always been really, like, weepy. I used to faint a lot when I was, like, a teenager. Like, I've just always been kind of, like, a really sensitive, sort of, like, delicate person. And so I don't think they thought I could handle it.
From that moment in Thanksgiving when you really realized that he was going to go until when he actually went, what was the timeline?
I mean, it was probably a week and a half.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Yeah. It was really
quick. Did you see
really
him or was Thanksgiving the last time you saw him?
Thanksgiving was the last time I saw him before the hospital. And that was where my mom called me and just said, "He's dying. Like, you have to come." And so thankfully, you know, we're talking 30-minute Metro North ride. So I was literally just able to, like, took the subway to Grand Central, hopped on a Metro North train and was able to be there in the last couple days in the hospital. And, like, everyone was there. Like, one of my older brothers was there. My younger brother was obviously there. My mom was there.
Was your father lucid?
You know, it got kind of gnarly. It was like
a bummer.
It was like, at first he was a little bit like, he knew who I was at first. Like, when I got there, he didn't say my name, but like I could tell that he knew who I was, and he was like happy to see me. By the end, there was so much pain medication and he was in so much pain. Like, he was like literally like writhing around in pain. He was at calling for his mom, which was like such a,
that's tough.
Like, it was like the hardest thing I've ever had to watch. And then he started talking about John L. Sullivan, who I had to look up, and he was a famous bare knuckle boxer from like the 1920s.
Okay.
And so it was like all over the place, and by like the very, very end, he was like just kind of passed out. But that was kind of like the trajectory that it took. And I remember, you know, I asked my mom to like leave the room so I could like say goodbye, even though he was like not conscious anymore. You know, and that was it. There was like, we were there for a couple days, and there was one night where we were like, we have to go home. Like, we've been here for 3 days. Like, we have to sleep. Like, my older brother had like, three little kids at the time. And he was just like, I can't leave my wife, you know, like for any longer. And that night though, we all went home is when he died. Like, it was like almost like the way I've processed it is just like, he just like needed to like be by himself. My mom was there, but the, like all of the kids had gone.
Yeah. Well, he's not in pain anymore. I'm glad you had at least a couple of days to communicate whatever, you know, felt like needed to be done in the moment. Obviously, I'm sure you were in shock. It's, grief comes in delays, you know, a little satellite delay, and then, oh, wow, I'm not over it at all.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know that there's, like, a getting over it, really. But, like, you learn to, you know, it's part of life, you know. It's, like, part of your reality. And I think, yeah, I was definitely in shock at the very beginning, especially, like I said, because, like, I didn't know the severity of it. And I almost really had needed to, like, I remember I went home for that Thanksgiving, and, like, my boyfriend at the time was with me. And he was like, he was the one who was like, that was like really scary. Like, you know, oh, like I, he was really freaked out. And
that was his first taste of mortality. And he was taking it harder than you.
Yeah. He was taking it harder than me. And that's the other thing too. If like people are listening to this that have like experienced grief, and this is the annoying thing for me is like when you have to take care of other people's reactions to it. When like you're like, it happened to me, like, right. Don't you start crying, like, sure. This isn't even your deal. So it was a little bit of that where like he was really freaked out by it, and he sort of like made me realize like how serious it was.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're the one that actually experienced it. It's just a matter of how you unpack it and sort of how you or if you unpack it, really. Do you remember after your father died the first time that you laughed? Or if there was any moment of levity the week after? Did anyone at the funeral say something that was supposed to be comforting, but it was just dumb?
Yeah, I mean, the funeral was really funny to me looking back because I hadn't really, like, planned to say anything. And I didn't know that anyone else was either. But then slowly but surely, like, each one of my siblings gets up and does, like, an amazing thing. So, like...
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's, like, you know, my oldest brother goes up. He's, like, I've prepared a poem and, like, reads this amazing poem. And then my other brother goes up and he is a trained opera singer. So he, like, sings Danny Boy facing my dad, brings down the house. My sister gets up and makes a speech and, like, she, you know... wasn't expected. And I was like, surely my younger brother's not going to get up and give a speech. And he gets up and like he gives a speech and I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to have to like do something right now.
Right.
And this is before stand up. This is before I had any public speaking chops whatsoever. And then that same boyfriend, he's like, you got to say something. And I was like, and I get up and I like couldn't get through saying anything. I just like started crying in front of everyone, which now I think is the funniest thing ever, because like now I would be the person who would like have the great speech written.
Yeah. And, yeah, of course.
And be like
be
able
real punchy.
Yeah, I would have had jokes in there, but I totally like bombed at my dad's funeral. And that's and like,
I think I'm glad that you got up there, because I feel like if you didn't stand up there and at least try to, you would probably have been like, what could have been?
No, totally. But I got up and it was the worst bomb of my life, which is now very funny to me, because everybody remembers it, but like no one ever talks about it because like it was bad.
I think you can be forgiven given the context of the situation. It's not like, it's not like you peed your pants on a roller coaster or something. You emotionally broke.
No. I did faint at a water park, though. So that's...
Well, I'm sure they give you shit for that all the time, too.
Yeah, it's true.
Old fainting Annie. So you also, you're doubly two times over. Both your parents are dead. And your mother was lost in a more sudden way. Previous guest, most recent one, Jeffrey Emerson, he was talking about how liberating it felt to not have any parents. And that felt so, such an interesting thing to me. What's it like on that end of the coin? Because I guess I'll be there someday. Well, of course I will.
Well, there's like some quote that I don't remember who said it, but it's like, make art like your parents are dead. And that it has been my experience where it's made me feel really free to write jokes about whatever I want. And to express myself however I want. Like, you know, I have tattoos that I have never shown to my parents. Like, anytime I was home before my mom died, I would wear like long sleeves, to the point where she's like, aren't you like hot? And so that's the level.
Wow, you could never go swimming.
Yeah, that's the level of like Catholic repression that we're talking in my family. So for me to be able to like fully be myself is a big deal. And that is something that I have like found since my mom has passed. And that's, you know, kind of like a silver lining where I don't necessarily have to like worry about how something's going to be received, or, you know, like I have different politics than my parents had. And there were a lot of debates at the dinner table around like how my beliefs were not correct.
Oh boy.
And I don't have those anymore. So
that's nice. That's Thanksgiving's a little less contentious.
Thanksgiving is less of a big deal. Like, No one is bugging me to give them a grandchild. Like, there's no eyes on my life in that way.
Sure.
So that part of it, I would say, is like what has come out of it for me. And like, the politics thing is so apt because when my mom died, it was like the fall of 2016. And like, I'm pretty sure the last I know the last conversation we had was about the 2016 election, and it did not end in a good way.
She was more of a Gary Johnson and you were more Bernie Sanders.
Well, I was in Vermont at the time. So you had to be Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, yeah. Or that's one of your tattoos that you've been hiding.
You were, chastised publicly, but like I will say, like, she had said something to me like talking about Trump and Hillary, and she was just like, well, I'm just disgusted with both of them, they're both equal. And I was just like, I will walk into the sea right now. So that was kind of it. And so when she ended up dying in early November of 2016, when we like were planning when her wake was going to be, I didn't think anything of the fact that it was also election night. And so we didn't even like realize that, okay, this is like we're going to do the wake Tuesday night and we're going to do the funeral on Wednesday. And frankly, I think I had booked it that way because it was the best value.
Sure. Yeah, of course. It's like getting married on September 11th.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Save a lot of money.
So I wasn't like, we weren't thinking about election night, and we just knew that we wanted to do the funeral midweek because like, yeah, we just couldn't do it on a Saturday. And so thought nothing of it, booked like, you know, the funeral home for the wake. My mom was not particularly religious, so we weren't doing like a church thing. And so we go into this wake and I'm just like kind of chatting with people, whatever. And we all have our phones off because like, who's on their phone at their mom's wake? And so we go in.
So you go in and Hillary's up.
Yeah, we go in and Hillary's up.
Oh, boy. Everybody cries.
And, you know, none of us are on our phones. And I'm just like not even thinking about it at all. And so we're in there for 2-3 hours. And then we start checking our phones and we're all like, what the fuck? And so it just added this like layer of just, I mean, talk about surreal upon surreal upon surreal. We were like, what? And like, I will also point out that all of like, you know, four siblings, or, you know, all five of us are there. And like, we all voted differently.
Okay. And oh, wow. So mixed reactions during Mom's wake.
One of us was a Jill Stein.
That's a long shot.
We're Hillary. One of us didn't vote, and one of us voted for Trump. And so...
That's a better breakdown than four against you.
Yeah, no, but it was...
four Trumps, that is.
And so then I'm mad at everyone for different reasons, right? And I'm just like, you know...
And Trumpy is actually got a little pep in their step, probably.
Yeah. And, okay. And he's like all of a sudden in a better mood.
And then the Hillary people are actually finally start crying.
Yeah. And I'm just yelling at my younger brother for voting for Jill Stein.
Right. You threw this for us.
And yeah. So that just added like this other layer of things. And then especially like waking up the next morning, I just remember I'm waking up in my childhood bedroom. And I wake up and I'm like, Trump is president. And also I'm about to go to my mom's funeral. And also my mom died with no plan in place whatsoever for any of like, we didn't know what she wanted for funeral burial stuff.
Right.
We didn't know what she wanted in terms of like.
She'd have a will?
No.
Jeez.
Nothing.
Yeah, that's tough.
Not that we found anyway. There was no will. There was no like end of life preferences. There was nothing. And because of the way that it all shook out and like, you know, my sister lives cross country. I have a brother who also lives out of state. And my younger brother was not in any shape.
I can already know where this is going. You became like, the executor?
Yeah.
Sorry to fucking step on your words.
So yeah, so I became not even the executor, but the administrator, because you have to become the administrator when there's no plan in place, which means that you have to go through the court system to even get appointed. So then I have to like, and keep in mind, I'm like just turning 30 at this point. I'm like doing all right, but I don't have like money laying around to like drop on paying a funeral and paying the extremely high taxes on my parents' house and paying the electric bill on my parents' house.
Yeah, and all that stuff's in someone else's name, presumably.
All of this stuff is in somebody else's name, and my younger brother's still living there. So like the house needs to be heated. There needs to be internet. There needs to be power. There needs to be food for him. Like all that stuff needs to happen. So I'm like, I need to like petition the court so I can like get a bank account, you know, something in my name or figure something
right
out, because I do not have the personal funds to like cover all this. You know, I'm like living in Vermont at the time, making a public radio salary and not able to really contribute. So that was like a whole process where I found a shoebox of cash like under my parents' bed.
Wow.
Which is how I paid for my mom's funeral.
Did you deposit or did you actually pay for it in cash at
the funeral
home? That's so funny.
In cash.
They're like fives and ones.
In, you know, whatever. And he was like, to his credit, he was like kind of a weirdo, but like he was not fazed by it. He was just like, I've seen.
He's like, this is better than change. It's not coined.
So there's that. So then, yeah. So then I have to petition the court, and then I have to go through the lengthy sort of like, estate administration process. I got to figure out how to sell my childhood home. I got to figure out how, like where my brother's going to go.
Yeah, he's vacating the space.
Yeah. I mean, that all took time.
And
you know, like we didn't do that immediately. He was probably there for 6 months, and you know, with us just like kind of using the money that you know was my mom's, like using that to kind of like keep the costs paid for. Had to like consolidate, figure out what outstanding bills she had, pay all those, and then figure out what bank accounts she might have had at other banks we didn't know about. So like, you know, it was just like basically a full-time job.
Oh yeah, there's so much red tape.
And it took like a year in total.
Yeah. And meanwhile, you have your whole life. And you were doing this from Vermont?
Yeah, remotely? And I was doing it all from Vermont. So I would actually drive back and forth a lot. So like, you know, this is obviously suburban New York. This, you know, I'm in Vermont. It's about a five and a half hour drive between the two. So I would just like use my vacation time and, you know, come down for days or weeks on end. You know, and I was doing things like trying to figure out how to clean out the house. My mom had a ton of stuff that nobody knew what to do with or wanted. You know, and then also figure out how to support my brother, who was like not having an easy time of things.
Was there any sort of, well, there's five of you. Is there sort of any sort of, I don't know, animosity about legally if she didn't leave a will? Like, you know,
no,
money
wasn't an issue because the way it works if somebody doesn't have a will is it just all gets split equally, which is what we all thought was fair in the first place.
Sure.
So nobody fought about that. I think what my brother and I fought about was his perception that I was being cold about the whole thing. And he was having a much more emotional time of it. And he also was like having a lot of issues around alcohol and, you know, was coping in the way that he was coping. And that got pretty scary. There was like one time I came home with my now ex, who I have to say was like incredible through this whole process. Like, I could not have done it. Like, he would literally like drive me to New York, and like, you know, there was one day that we were all at the house and I just look up and Paul, my ex, is like just cleaning out the entire attic by himself. And I'm like, no, you don't have to do that. Like, no one asked you to do that. He's like, it needs to be done. I'm doing it. So he just like really just did the shit that no one else wanted to do. He like went through my mom's bedroom just to make sure there wasn't like personal items that I didn't want to see, and disposed of anything that I wouldn't want to see before I had to see it.
Shout out to Paul.
Yeah. So Paul was great. But like there was one time we got there and my brother had drank like half a bottle of whiskey and like had punched a wall. So like really cliche stuff, but it's just like, when it's happening, you're like, oh my God, this is like the worst thing that's happened like to our family, you know, to see him in pain like that. But, you know, he had like a really great girlfriend who's now his wife. They're now on their second kid and he is now sober for however many years.
That's great.
And he's doing amazing. But at the time, things were tough because like we were all processing it like in our own ways. And my way of processing everything is like checklist. What needs to be done? Let's just do it.
You're the taskmaster.
You know? Totally.
Yeah. Well, I mean, good on you for whether or not you wanted to do it, for accepting that role. How was the relationship with the rest of your siblings? You guys still close? Did it bring you closer together? Or did you guys find more, I don't know, more about yourselves, more about how you interact in the family dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, we're the same level. Like, we have had, you know, we've had like the holidays, you know, that we've done where it's like, you know, we'll either go to my brother's house who lives in the New York suburbs, or, you know, I think this year I might go to my younger brother. They actually moved to North Carolina and bought a house there. So it's interesting that everyone's gotten older and like all, you know, married and with kids and stuff, because like I've noticed that because we're like the orphan family, like we really tend to get absorbed into like the in-laws. That is something that like has been interesting to see, like with my younger brother. He's like very, like so close with his wife's family. So it's like now it's more like about his kids and their family and his in-laws. And so,
you know, your nieces and nephews don't have grandparents on that side. So
exactly. So they're really close with, you know, the other side's grandparents. So I think that that's, whereas like, you know, I have older nieces and nephews who did get a chance to know my parents and, you know, also had their own experiences with the with the deaths, and they at least like had the experience of like losing their grandparent, you know, while still having met them. Whereas like my little nieces and nephews like just have never met my parents.
Yeah, it's you know, same goes for me. I never met my father's father. He never met his only grandchild, which is you know, it's tough, but I guess that's the luck of the draw. You know, I try to keep my memory of my father alive, and you know, sort of. But yeah, it is what it is, you know. So you said that you wrote jokes about it, and now do you feel like you're coming back around to it? Do you feel like there's more you want to explore comedically? Or, and also, like, when I do these, it makes me realize how much I should go to therapy, because I don't really actually, only until like maybe a couple hours before recording these, and certainly post recording these, I go for a nice long walk. But I'm like, man, I should really think about this stuff with more frequency. And then I go, I don't know if I have the energy for that.
Yeah. Well, I'm doing therapy literally in 2 hours from now.
So that's your post podcast. Yeah, that's calm down.
My post podcast. So shout out to therapy. I feel like that is
helpful.
It is very helpful. And yeah, you know, I think I don't really remember what the question was.
Do you feel like you have more to explore comedically?
Oh, yeah. Do I have more? You know, I think so. I think that like there's more to say about like the whole the end of life stuff and the estate stuff. Like, you know, if anyone cares about their kids, I would really urge them to make a plan, even if they don't think they need the plan for many, many years. That is like something that I feel like is still like, I didn't tell jokes about it because it was so annoying. And it was so like, I would just like get mad every time I had to go to the bank again, or I had to go call the fucking, you know, right, insurance company again and explain the whole thing to yet another person and like just do more and more of this bureaucracy. So that's something I feel like I haven't touched in comedy that I could. And now, like I said, I'm really focusing on like, my mom was a total weirdo. We had like a really tough relationship. And I'm just starting to like be able to write jokes about that. And so that is like kind of where I'm focused now. And she is dead, so I can say whatever I want.
Yeah, no rebuttals. Well, that's good. It sounds like you're doing the work. And whatever the work is, you know, it's nice to explore the stuff that's in your head, because a lot of people don't, and they go, hey, I'll think about that when I'm
The thing that I try to remember too is like, you know, I try to be mindful of my family members who are still living when I'm writing jokes. I mean, my younger brother is really easy to make fun of, but he, like, I do kind of like try to take into consideration that like, just like you have different relationships with your parents when they're alive, you also have that when they're dead too. So it's like, I have to respect his grief process and how he's grieving, and something that I might think is funny might upset him. So I try to take that into consideration.
I understand. I totally want to not to put words into anybody else's mouth, and a lot of the stuff I speculate about my father, I don't really know. And I don't know if it's necessarily my story to tell. But then at the same time, I'm like, well, who else is... I don't know. It's... grief fucking is very different. And everyone has their own unique take. And people can experience the exact same moment and come away with completely different...
Totally. Within the same family, dealing with the same person.
People can have different memories of the same event. And then you kind of have...
Yeah.
I understand the importance of being like, oh, I don't want to offend anyone. Kind of like when I first started stand-up, I was like, you know what? I'm going to write all these political jokes. I'm going to be the next, you know, Bill Hay. I'm going to change the world with my observations, and then my parents will be proud of these jokes. And then I was like, what the fuck am I doing? I should write things that are funny. Yeah. Funny over everything. And then also, my parents, you know, I love both of them, but there's going to be a disconnect. They are different people than me, you know?
Yeah.
And I think I understand wanting to like divorce yourself from
Yeah, I try not to use the grief material as a crutch, like I said, but also like my one of my like tenets that I believe in comedy is like I try to write jokes that only I can say that feel emotionally true and real for me. And so that means that I'm not worried about anyone stealing a joke, or and I'm not worried about stealing anybody else's material, and I'm not worried about sounding like myself. So it's like, if that means that some grief stuff comes up, like that's going to happen.
Sure. That's an interesting bar to set for yourself. I like that. I usually just repackage other things that I...
Yeah, you're like, I'm just mostly steal jokes. Yeah, yeah. I actually go on Twitter, sorry, X, and I just, see what else is on there.
Thank you for respecting Elon's new identity.
I did leave Twitter, and I feel great.
Yeah, good for you. Let's loop around for a big dismount. That's what I call death. The final dismount. Well, let me ask you, I think you're the fourth person I've interviewed who's had both stars of the double dead parents. And they said you're next is basically what they realized once their parents died. Do you find that you contemplate mortality more now or less, or are you still just sort of unpacking what it's been like?
Yeah, I think about it a lot more now. I think also I'm worried about like what I want to do in my time. And like, how do I want to use
your legacy
and my voice? And you know, it sounds like super, super pretentious, but like, I also just am pretty pretentious.
Sure, staying on brand.
Yeah, like it's like, how do I want to use my voice, my time? How do I want to like be here? And I think about that stuff a lot more now.
I don't think that's pretentious. And I also think in relationship to, your father's death, you reevaluate time because 6 months now means something very different to you.
Yeah.
And if I were to be like, oh, geez, if I had 6 months to live, I would probably at least change some of my behaviors and, you know, put a little more effort into, I guess, realizing what it is that I want to do.
Yeah, and you don't know, like... Yeah, you don't know how much time you have at all. So I think that's what I try to kind of like remember. You always think you have more time to do things than you do. And the other piece of it that I really try to remember and try to take away from it, it's like, it's not too late. Like I can get in my head about it being too late. Like I'm too old to do this or that, or like I can't, you know, do this. And I think since losing my mom, it's been like, well, no, like you can.
Yeah, you can do anything.
You still have time. You're alive.
You so have you can. Your time.
Yeah.
And I guess that's how I use it. That matters ultimately. Speaking of being pretentious. Well, I appreciate you coming on here telling me about your death experiences. It's time for the plugs. What's
more? Okay, I'm gonna plug some stuff, and you can. When is this coming out?
Probably in a day or two. Do you have something coming up this week?
Well, there is some stuff that I would like people to come to, which is you can come to Hello Beautiful, which is the first Friday of every month. It's at Chow Bella in Prospect Lefferts. It's a really fun show that I do with Patrick Hasty. The next one is on, I think it's December 1st. It's a Friday. And I'm also producing a show called Killing Jokes. And that is happening at Interborough Brewing and Spirits on November 20th. And that is, That's going to be really fun. I realize I talked about the December Hello Beautiful, and I should have mentioned the November one, but you
come
get
to the
it.
November one also.
You get it. The
it's,
November
it will
one,
certainly be out before it's October 23rd.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The November one, you should
first
definitely.
First Friday, did you say?
Yeah, it's the first Friday of the month, and you should come because it's always really fun.
Cool. Well, I appreciate you giving me, you know, all this stuff. Appreciate you letting me turn your trauma into
content.
Episode 26. Like and subscribe, folks. Annie Russell, thanks for helping me figure out my computer audio. Thanks for
telling.
And you know, good luck on this afternoon therapy session. Maybe you can give me a referral. I need to find one.
Yeah.
If anybody listening at home knows people who take Fidelis Care in Queens or Brooklyn, DM me. That's about it. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Appreciate it. And thus concludes episode 26. Thanks for listening, everybody. And I want to thank Annie Russell for sharing her story with me. Check out her show, Hello Beautiful, at Ciao Bella, first Friday of every month. And Killing Jokes, November 20th. And if you enjoy the podcast, as always, feel free to like, subscribe, maybe even do some public graffiti in support. I'm really trying to get the word out on this, but the numbers are going up, and that's been good for my serotonin levels. And, you know, when people message me, that also makes me feel good. You can like, subscribe, give it 5 stars, do all the things, and keep coming back. More episodes coming soon. Goodbye.